It is 23 and a half past the hour. It is a Wednesday morning, and on the line, well, I don't know if it's right to say you're on the line. He's on the internet with us in close communication. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And Doug, I think you're coming to us from what? Is it McKinney, Texas you're in?
Yes, as a matter of fact. And I wonder if instead of being on the line, I'm on the hook.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Yeah. Yeah, we've got so much to cover because we missed you for a couple of weeks here between your travels and missed you last week. And we were kind of in the middle of the Christmas season, the Advent stories, and with so much to cover. And I feel like we just ran out of time. But there's one kind of missing chapter that always delights me to hear your teaching on. And that's, my temptation is to say the three wise men. But they don't know that they were wise men. We don't know that there were three of them either, do we?
No, we do know that they bought three gifts.
Yeah, that's about it.
But before we jump into that,
yeah,
you know how I love quotes that sort of illustrate why biblical context matters and how important it is. I ran across something the other day, and I'm still massaging it around because I want to customize it for Preserving Bible Times, and context always matters. But it goes like this. Reading the Bible without context is like trying to listen to Bach always and only played on a harmonica.
Uh-oh. That's a good illustration. I like that. I'm pondering that.
You can discern the general tune, but all of the other richness which would come out on a 3-5 rank organ is missing.
You know, that reminds me of that Geico commercial where the guy makes a big deal out of his triangle solo, jumps out of a symphony orchestra. Yeah, it works. Well, that's true. Context is it's what's between the lines. It's the stuff that gives color to the information there. And I've been reading Luke lately, and I've never read it the same since you started teaching me and us about it. Every chapter, every verse now has something more significance to it than it ever had before. And that's what that's about. It all comes together now. It fits like a big jigsaw puzzle. And before, it was just pieces of that puzzle.
That's a pretty good way to look at it. You could also say, without context, it's like trying to put the puzzle together without ever having seen what the puzzle box top looks like.
And because we're not acquainted with that culture, all the pieces are gray. They all look the same.
Yeah, if we're fortunate, they're gray. Most likely they're missing.
Yeah.
MIA, and missing in action.
Well, Preserving Bible Times is just invaluable to us and to listeners. And notice more and more people tuning in for a broadcast with you. That's because they learn from it. And I just should, as long as you Doug Greenwald fans are listening, you should know that at BrokenRoadRadio.com, if you go to the top of the homepage, you'll see a thing marked Podcasts. And if you click on that, you'll see Doug's name there. You can click on his name, and there'll be a whole chronologically arranged collection of his podcasts with us over the past 6 years. Each has a couple sentences that kind of introduces the topic. Each one lasts about 30 minutes. You can download it and listen at your leisure, or you can listen to it right there online. But this is such a valuable library of thought and teaching now. I can't let that go unmentioned. So you should know about that.
You know, something else has crossed my path, too. I was talking to Brad Gray, one of my teaching colleagues, who has joined with me to create the Institute of Biblical Context. And he was all excited because he had run across something in Nashville, Tennessee called the Storyboard, I think it is, creating a storyboard brand. And that's, of course, a marketing term whenever you hear the word brand. But the thesis was every story that's told, whether it's an advertising story or a story by Jesus, if it's truly effective, it always has the same seven pieces to it. And that really caught my attention because that implies framework. And it began to say that if you lose or drop out or overlook any of those seven pieces in the telling of the story becomes less and less compelling. And so there are effective storytellers and there are not so effective storytellers. And anyway, I'm getting ready to dive into this book here on my semi-sabbatical. But I got through the first 7 pages of it. It's probably a 200-page book. And I was already hit in the face because he was saying you not only have to describe in your positioning statement what you do, but why it matters. And as I think I passed along in abbreviated form before, but that caused me to wonder, my goodness, for 17 years, the slogan, the positioning statement, the byline for Preserving Bible Times has been because context matters. And 3 or 4 years ago, we updated that to be because context always matters. But even as an old marketing guy, it just hit me over the head. It doesn't say why it matters. Mm-hmm. And so I've been playing with a new byline. It gets to be a little bit longer, but it's something along these lines that Preserving Bible Times is using context to bring the Bible alive so that God's people can thrive. That's the impact of context. Those passages start to become alive in fresh and new ways, and it impacts God's people in positive transformational ways, and it causes them to thrive in their spiritual walk and in their spiritual journey. So that's some phraseology thoughts that I'm kicking around in my head here, is there's a reason why context matters, and it's so that God's people can thrive. And when we look across the broad sweep of Western evangelicalism these days and we see so much anemia, you think there's cause and effect?
Yeah, I do.
What they're being taught and what they're being told from pulpits isn't compelling, isn't necessarily contextually restored, isn't getting close to the original meaning always intended by the Holy Spirit for that passage, and therefore anemia rather than transformation is more the byproduct of the day.
You know, the other thing I've seen for those churches that do teach context and teach it well and know it, they grow like crazy because people are so hungry for that information. Once they're exposed to it, it's as if they never knew it existed before, and it's like food. It's manna. It's nourishment all of a sudden.
And it becomes exciting, and it becomes compelling.
It does.
There it ought to be, I'll use some Catholic language here, it ought to be a cardinal sin to teach a boring sermon or a boring class for Sunday school or adult education. Yeah. These are truly exciting stories. And anyway, that's just some of what's been kicking around my mind for this new year as well.
Okay, well, that sounds like productive work. And if we could, you want to get into the three kings, the three wise
sure,
men?
Sure, let's do it.
Numbers 1, 2, and 3, but you know, there might have been a dozen of them, huh? We don't know.
That's true. And even if it was just three kings, we don't know that, but even if it was just three, it would have been quite an entourage that traveled with them.
I understand that there was a Greek writing a couple of hundred years written after the Bible, after the first century, so maybe 3rd, 4th century, and they actually named those three, and probably they assumed that or they made that up because of the three gifts, and that's how they settled on three, but it really has no relation to the actual historical event.
Now, we don't know the number of wise men. We do know they brought three gifts, and as a responder emailed me a month or so ago, there were three kinds of gifts, meaning multiple gifts in three categories, some gold gifts, some myrrh gifts, and some frankincense gifts. That's an interesting way to look at it. But either way, it's the symbolism of those gifts that truly matters. Just to back up a little bit, there's lots of fanciful thought that surrounds who these wise men were. I mean, just in the last 30 days, I've heard or read of views like this. The wise men couldn't have followed a star. It had been too difficult to have a star, you know, lead them precisely to Bethlehem and a particular small one-room home in the sub-basement there where they were most likely staying. No, it was God's Shekinah glory that led them. I said to myself, well, that's kind of imaginative. And then others will say, no, these were Persians. No, these were Nabataeans. And so there's all sorts of, and here's another school of thought. They showed up the next morning after the birth of Jesus, not up to 2 years later. So even in the most well-known, quote-unquote, Bible story, there are lots of loose ends that lots of people have and have projected and created around this. And it does raise an interesting issue to me. If we're not clear, if we don't totally understand all the pieces of the most well-known story of all, the birth of Jesus, the one story at least we all know, right? What might that say about some of the other passages that we're not quite so familiar with?
Indeed. And for hundreds of years, traditions developed around, well, the whole story, but certainly around the wise men too. And supposedly in Iran, they went back to their home and they founded churches there and became Christians and developed a Christian tradition in Iran. And that was thought to be the case for hundreds of years. I don't know how historically accurate that is, but tradition gets in the way, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and for a long time, the historic Roman Church, tradition had equal weight with Scripture in terms of its veracity. So, you know, I think it's a little cloudy, but it seems to be around 850 AD is where the historic church sort of decided that Jesus was a carpenter. And that's been with us for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he might have done a little carpentry, but you can't make a living as a carpenter in a culture where everything is built by stone. Mm-hmm. Most likely he was a stonemason and did a little bit of carpentry on the side. I can develop the logic of that, you know, in much more depth, maybe at a later time. But it is amazing how tradition has become equal to the truth, or in some cases has moved the truth off to the side. But anyway, back to these wise men.
Yeah, and that's why context. The context is verifies what has later become tradition or bad habits.
Yeah, we could use a bunch of
verifies and corrects.
50-cent words here. Mm-hmm. It clarifies, mm-hmm. It elucidates, expands, mm-hmm. and often takes a one-dimensional quick apprehension of a passage and gives us a three-dimensional comprehension of a passage. And sometimes that can make all the difference in the world. But let me suggest as a hypothesis here that the wise men had to be Jewish. Because who else is looking for the King of the Jews? Who else would even know that there is to be a prophesied King of the Jews? Not the Persians, not the Nabataeans, not the Egyptians. And when we go back and look at how the rabbis have sort of taken over this culture and the ideas and the paradigms that they promulgated, one of them goes back to Numbers 24, verse 17, which reads, I see him, but not now. Bear with me here, I have to sneeze.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll just kind of, radio guys can't stand silence.
Yeah, you could hum Route 66 for those 4 seconds here. I see him, but not now, and the rabbis have come to conclude that this is a messianic passage. I see him, Messiah, but not now. I behold him, Messiah, but not close at hand. A star will march forth out of Jacob, and a scepter will rise out of Israel. So the rabbis have said one of the ways that we'll know that Messiah is imminent is there will be a great star suddenly appearing in the skies, okay? So that's why, one reason, Jews would be searching the skies for a new star. And only Jews would be doing that because only Jews are driven by the Torah.
Well, they were very conscious of sky things anyway. I mean, the calendar was dictated by the moon and the festivals, and so they had their attention on the heavens.
Well, you're walking right into the next logical point here, is that Jews have a great preoccupation with astronomy, not to be confused with astrology. Mm-hmm. They were astronomers because they were maintaining two calendars, lunar and solar, and God had given them precise dates for each of the festivals, and they were consumed with always doing it exactly the way God wanted things done, because he's a holy God, and that's part of the way you honor him. And so they're constantly searching the stars to determine the calendar dating from year to year for the major festivals. So they would be looking at the stars on an ongoing basis for calendar reasons, and then all of a sudden a new star showed up, and they began to think of the prophetic nature the rabbis had given them about Numbers 24, verse 17. And that's why I would suggest these pretty much had to be Jewish men, not of any other ethnic persuasion. Hmm. Now, when you read other portrayals of these wise men, some say that they're magicians. Some say that they're astrologers. And I would drop in on Jeremiah 10, because remember, a serious Jew would have memorized the Old Testament, mm-hmm. probably before age 13. And so let's read Jeremiah verses 1 and 10 from Jeremiah 1 and 2 from Jeremiah 10. You people of Israel, listen to what the Lord has to say to you. The Lord says, do not start following pagan religious practices. Do not be in awe of signs that occur in the sky, even though the other nations hold them in awe. Okay? So an observant Jew is prohibited from astrological work, from zodiac determinations and all that kind of thing. Doesn't mean that all Jews were. One of the fascinating things they discovered in the remains of a synagogue around Tiberias, built after the death of Jesus around 100 AD, they found a zodiac in the floor, the mosaic floor of that particular synagogue. Mm-hmm. So astrology had made inroads into aspects of Judaism, and here in Jeremiah 10, God forbids it. And therefore, I think it's really inaccurate to refer to these wise men as magicians or astrologers, from what other culture you might think they have come.
I just want to pass along a comment from a listener, too. It says, yay, Doug, I've heard that Jews in Babylon from Daniel's time were searching and believing.
Yes.
And I've heard the same thing, that they may well have come from Babylon because it was a center of Jewish thought and study and development. And there may well have been very knowledgeable Jews looking for the Messiah in Babylon.
There is a very vibrant and a very large community in Babylon. Most of the Jews did not come back on the three waves with Ezra and Nehemiah to rebuild the wall and the temple in 536, which was rededicated in 516. And so, yeah, there's probably hundreds of thousands of Jews in Babylon, and these are most likely Jews from the exile, these mm-hmm. three wise men who have returned to seek their Messiah. Mm-hmm. So they brought three gifts. Well, the first gift, gold, is really practical. I mean, the Holy Family here is about to head to Egypt, and they're going to need some means to live in Egypt. And so this gold will be what we will call today liquidity. It gives them money. It gives them funding. It gives them a nest egg to survive their years in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Frankincense. There's a certain kind of frankincense. That's one of the four ingredients that's used at the incense offering at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the temple. It's the most prestigious offering of the day. It's the offering that Zechariah was selected by lot to do as he was about to retire from the ordinary priesthood. And what's characteristic about that formula of four ingredients is one of the ingredients, the frankincense, when it hits the hot coals, it evokes a really pure white smoke that, that ascends to the heavens. And the symbolism of that is that the ascending prayers of the people are carried up to the heavens to Yahweh. Okay, so if that frankincense is used as part of the mix of incense that's used for the incense offering, this second gift may well be symbolizes the offering, the sacrificial offering that he's going to make at the very end of his life, and that symbolism arrives at the very beginning of his life. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a sacrifice, a sacrificial offering. And then myrrh is, to use our language today, part of the embalming methodology, okay? It's part of what was put on the body to try to reduce the stench that decomposition will occur. And the way myrrh is collected, it's from a very, you'd almost say scrawny wilderness kind of bush shrub, where it's the bark is pierced quite deeply down to the core. I think in biological terms, it's called the phylum. Don't hold me to that. Mm-hmm. But the tree is wounded. And it's wounded in a number of places, and it starts to ooze, sort of like maple syrup does. The maple trees in New England in the wintertime, you have to wound the tree to get the sap to flow. And so the myrrh may very well be suggestive of what's going to happen to him during his sacrificial act on the cross. He is going to be wounded, and he is going to ooze blood.
Well, the assumption here is that these three Jews, let's call them Jews for the sake of our discussion this morning, not only knew and expected a Messiah, but they knew the circumstances around him, because they would have known what the prophets had said was going to happen from Isaiah to Jeremiah, that he would die.
Well, if, and they're, remember, they've memorized their Old Testament, so they have memorized Psalm 22. Mm-hmm. And there, in quite excruciating detail, it's described how Messiah will die.
Mm-hmm. And written at a time when crucifixion was not generally practiced.
Isn't that fascinating?
It is astounding. If you read Psalm 22, and now we're going to get into the last words of Jesus, which will take me the rest of the afternoon here, I think. It's such a just an incredible teaching, but and there, then there's the issue of when they came. I still hold to. I mean, it tells us in Luke that they came to the house where Mary and the child were staying. They don't mention Joseph. They don't mention anything else. It implies, and then of course Herod was after infants or toddlers, 2 years and younger in his pogrom there.
I think that's the significant thing. You know, why would Herod specify 2 years? My intuition says they showed up about at the 18-month point, and just to put a little further extension to make sure his entrapment window was covered all possibilities, Herod added 6 months to that and then issued the decree that everyone 2 years or younger be killed. There would be no reason for Herod to specify 2 years. If, as some contend, the wise men showed up the next day in Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm. Interesting story. And we never get tired of hearing it, because there's always more angles to consider in this. I mean, it's not like, even with an understanding of the context, we don't know the whole story, and probably can't. But if we want to go as far as possible in understanding, that context is absolutely essential, what we do know.
You know, what context does, it expands the circumference of the story, but at the same time, the larger the circumference becomes, the more questions and other thoughts appear on the boundaries.
Well, that's true, and I'm thinking of all the teaching you've done with us over the last 6 years now, 6.5 years. It's changed the way I look at the Bible entirely. In fact, it's changed the way I go to church and what I expect from a church now. And I hope that Bible Times is having that kind of an effect in lots of churches, because you have done some good work and intense work over the years. Now you're down in Texas teaching. Tell us about that. You've been there for, what, a week or two, huh?
I am. I'm teaching on a Monday night at a small Bible study, and I'm teaching at Tuesday night for a large Bible study. I'm about to walk out the door here. In fact, I have to end up in the next couple minutes to get down to Highland Park, just the near-end suburb of Dallas, to do a Wednesday morning Bible study. So I'm keeping busy.
Okay. Well, that's good to know that you're productively engaged, Doug. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. By the way, if you're listening to Broken Road from our website today, there's a link to preservingbibletimes.org. You can go there and sign up for Doug's monthly newsletter. He calls them Reflections, and sometimes there's more than one a month. You look forward to them. Comes to you in email, and it doesn't cost a penny, but it will light up your day when you see one of those arrive in your inbox. Doug, travel safely. We'll look forward to talking with you next week. I hope we can.
Thanks, guys. I'm planning on it. And shalom, shalom.
Take care.
Okay.
Shalom, Doug.
See you, Doug.